I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Jaws, the 1975 film screenplay by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb, based on the novel Jaws by Peter Benchley, directed, of course, by Steven Spielberg. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So the story of doing this film and this video has a long history. Because, you know, Jaws is one of my favorite films, and I've been trying to get these guys to do a video about Jaws for
lies. Lies.
But no, so in truth, people have been pushing me to do a video on Jaws, particularly Trisha has been vocal about Jaws. So Trisha, why did you want to talk about Jaws?
Jaws is fascinating. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And it is one of those situations where, you know, the production was notoriously bad. It went very badly. And yet it came together to be an incredible landmark, just awesome film that really holds up on rewatch. And the script, as it turned out, I mean, they didn't have a proper script or like not a good script when they started shooting. But because they went so long in the schedule, they ended up coming up with like a pretty great script. And I thought it was an amazing example of how a team works together or doesn't work together and how that contributes to like basically creates the twists and turns of the plot. They are three people on a unified team up against one simple antagonist. It's a really excellent example. You know, it's that classic like man versus nature. But the construction of the team and the way that they interact and their varying backgrounds and their egos and how they clash is what makes the entire second half of this interesting and worth watching. I really, really wanted to do a video about the design of supporting characters for that reason. And then you guys just video gamed it, which was not what I wanted at all. But I am happy with how it turned out. But it was just a completely different approach to the entire thing. So,
yeah, well, because I remember you pitching this idea of harmony and dissonance.
Yeah.
And you saying that really resonated with me, as that's a clear way to move the plot forward, is when you have your team in harmony, mm-hmm. things are working well. But when those same traits are causing conflict, there's dissonance, that's also moving the plot, you know, forward in a different way, creating that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was as we were discussing all of this and how you know, different characters have different traits and all this stuff, that everyone was kind of just like,
not everyone,
but Trisha was like, this sounds like a video game and, you know, character selection in a video game. And it's always, I think it's fun to try to find, you know, references that other people might have a handle on already to help explain an idea.
Sure.
And ultimately, I think, yeah, we all arrived at this was a cool way to use Tirzu, whose channel's all about using video game lingo to explain biology, which is a crazy idea, but also is great and super popular. Borrowing him to help get across this idea of how you design your characters as a team matters and will help you move the plot forward.
Yeah, I think it's useful anytime we can give this sort of either visual or numerical identity to something that sounds like this just general idea in filmmaking. And I think with Casino Royale, I loved when we started working on that video of the opening chase sequence that I just said, oh, the actual physical distance they are from the ground is Freytag's pyramid in screenwriting. And I thought, what a great way to show anybody, here's the structure of a movie. You can actually literally watch the characters go straight and then up and then down. And then, and I think that it's one thing to say, make sure your character has traits or does this or whatever. It's another to say, pick an idea and where does your character actually literally fall on a scale? You don't have to actually come up with numbers and assign them numbers, but it's a helpful way to get people really thinking about character and what makes characters different and where the conflict comes from and where the harmony comes from.
Exactly.
And as a visual person, I always just really enjoy seeing these things in kind of a graphic visual format. So that's why it was so much fun to take Tirzu's, you know, kind of 8-bit character ranking stats profile and apply it to these, you know, characters from a 1975 Steven Spielberg film. You know, it was just a really fun kind of remix. And I really it really helped me appreciate this film more, because I honestly have not rewatched it over and over again the same way I've rewatched Jurassic Park or some other Spielberg classics. And so I didn't really have a deep knowledge of, you know, why these three characters work so well together. And it actually helped me appreciate the film more to see it laid out that way. So, yeah, it worked for me as a dude who plays video games, of course.
I think the thing especially about Jaws is how small the team is. And that's another thing that makes it a really, really good example of this. You know, we use some other examples in the video of larger teams and like team assemblies. So we referenced Ocean's 11 and Mission Impossible movies and
Lord of the Rings.
A lot. Lord of the Rings and Ghostbusters. Those things are all thrown in there. But every single one of those teams is larger. And so if you really are going to chart how the team fits together and works with harmony and dissonance, it becomes a little messier. And I have every confidence that in those movies that we just mentioned, there's a plan and there's, you know, the characters are designed with lots of thoughtfulness to have opposing traits as well as traits that are harmonious in the sense that they fill in each other's like gaps in their weaknesses and things like that. But Jaws is such a simplified version of that, where it's just these three men. They have one united goal, and their differing traits really pit them against each other. So they have these differences in class, and they have these differences in backgrounds, what they think about technology, as we pointed out, where their weaknesses are and where their strengths are. They really clash. They also really fit well together. They're exactly who you need to go after this mission. And so, you know, the characters were wildly changed from the book. Not wildly, but they were significantly changed from the book. Quint is probably the one who's most similar from the book to the movie. But just how this movie plays out, there's a reason why this trio is so iconic today. Yeah.
Yeah. So the pitch happened, this idea of harmony and dissonance, I really liked. Everything you were just saying is like, yeah, that sounds good. I don't remember Jaws very much at all either, like Alex. And so part of the struggle was getting me to like finally just sit down and like, fine, I'll watch Jaws. Because I feel like it's one of those movies where I've seen so much of it in, you know, various behind the scenes, either, you know, special features or documentaries or the lifetime of Steven Spielberg, and you see stuff. So like, it's one of those I feel like I've spent a bunch of time with, but the actual number of times I've sat and watched it start to finish is very low. And so I went in a little apprehensive. I was gonna like, what's this gonna be? And I was just completely impressed. Like, the shark still looks fake, but it doesn't matter because the construction of the movie is so good. And it's one of those that I was watching it and it didn't feel like a 1975 movie. It felt timeless. Part of that, I think, is because Richard Dreyfuss's character feels like a modern day hipster to me. Like, he looks like he walked out of 2020. But yeah, it was so good for all those reasons you were saying, Trisha. And it also helped that I think we did our Jurassic Park podcast while we were working on it.
Yeah, definitely.
Realizing that, like, oh, Jaws was like Jurassic Park training. Like, all the things that happened in Jurassic Park that are great were first great in Jaws. And definitely. It was really cool to see Spielberg kind of arriving at those tools and those techniques so early on.
Exactly.
I was really struck by just how even in this early era of Spielberg, he was already a master at staging these scenes where he uses the frame like so efficiently, you know, the way the characters move through the frame, letting things play out, the blocking is masterful. I was enthralled actually in some ways more with the first half of the film than the second half, because
he was 26 years old
and had made two movies.
So I hate it so much. It's so ridiculous.
We were all supposed to be Spielberg.
Oh man,
now here we are.
Well, that's, you know, every frame of painting has a million great videos, obviously. But one of my favorites is the Spielberg Winner.
Yep.
And he talks about that. And so, I mean, just go watch that video if you haven't.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember that video suddenly when there's the long take of getting on the ferry. And there, it's just this long shot where they're traveling on the ferry and the mayor's talking to
Brody.
Brody, thank you. Yeah, and just like the masterful, as you were saying, Alex, the blocking and how much that can do when you constrain yourself with, we're not going to cut, this is the frame. The frame can move, but this is where it's all going to happen. And just watching that ballet of like, this person moves here and that person moves there is just so great. And it just makes me so happy. It's just so good. And I wish we did more of it. And I think as someone that is a very editor-minded, it stresses me out to think of committing to that many one-ers. But it's so effective when it's used intelligently and in the right moments for that right effect.
Yeah,
because they don't feel like one-ers in the sense of,
right.
Oh, like time's kind of dragging because they've like decided to do this big one-er right now. It feels just like what would normally be shot as like a shot reverse shot sequence playing out in a single frame. But yeah, somehow the tempo, the energy of the scene isn't lost in the fact that it's this one shot.
Yeah, and I think it also, it keeps the movie from doing the other end of the spectrum, which is the cut to a character to see how they respond to a thing, which if the character's in frame, I can look at them to see how they respond to something. Mm-hmm. But if you think about comedies or like sitcoms or comedies from the mid-90s, early 2000s, there was always that cut to grandma because she's, you know, upset about it or whatever. And it's like, we don't need all that. And granted, a comedy is a different pacing. It's a different style. But anytime I see the wide shot or the one or where Spielberg will actually, it's a couple shots in one shot and he's just moving the
right.
camera.
It becomes another shot. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Anytime I see that used effectively, I think it's just so much more, it's so much more immersive too. I feel more involved with the movie than I do when it's just these suddenly jarring cuts that don't really add anything to the scene.
I think part of the thing that contributes to this, I don't know, the pacing that you're talking about where it doesn't feel like it drags is because Spielberg is not afraid to let other characters speak when even when they're not, it's not the main part of the dialogue. It's not something you even really need to hear, but there's often people like mumbling in the background or there's competing conversations happening. So I think about in Jurassic Park, the sort of like full maturity of that is the scene by the raptor paddock,
yes.
where there's literally yes. two conversations happening at the same time. And they're actually both scripted and they're in the mix almost at the same level. Like at different moments, there's one slightly above the other where Hammond is talking to Dr. Sattler about something. And then Grant is talking to the raptor hunter whose name is
Muldoon.
Muldoon, thank you. And they're having that conversation simultaneously. It really reminds me of the scene in this movie where the reporters are in the room and the reporters are, you know, everyone's crowded into that tiny space at the police station. And there's multiple conversations going on. Brody is talking to Mayor Vaughn at the front of the room. That woman reporter who is there is talking to somebody else. And the thing on the ferry is the same way, where they're kind of looking at each other. They're having almost different conversations at the same time. It's that super naturalistic approach to directing them. It's like, yeah, you can talk. You would talk to each other in the way that you naturally would. And I think that's one of the things that Jaws does unbelievably well is that like super natural, super grounded style of dialogue delivery. Like these guys are allowed to mumble. They're allowed to talk over each other. Some of the most famous lines in this, like that's some bad hat, Harry, is not the one you even first hear because it's kind of thrown away by Brody, right?
Yeah, I think we talked about this in Apocalypse Now is how much the 70s had such a real raw feeling in a lot of movies from the 70s.
Yes.
And I think that Spielberg almost does it too much sometimes. I think it's Close Encounters or maybe it's E.T. where there's a scene with a family around the dinner table. Everyone is speaking.
Everyone is talking at the same time and you can't understand anything.
Right. I think Close Encounters does it too. And Jaws does it plenty. So it's definitely what he was going for around that time. But yeah, you have the overlapping dialogue. You have a lot of improvised dialogue, which he actually encouraged the actors to do and say, you know what your scene is, you know what your lines are, but kind of do your own thing, say it however it feels natural. On top of that, he actually cast a lot of locals from Martha's Vineyard.
Yes.
So you have people who aren't really actors and granted, that sometimes can mean you get bad performances, but you just get people who look very real and earthy and don't feel actory and that kind of thing. You know, Roy Scheider has this story about how he was off screen with the younger son actor, mm-hmm. and everything he was doing, the kid would just start imitating, and he started making like a growly face, and the kid did too. So he just went over and said, "Steven, come here," and called him over and showed him, and he said, "Great, that's a real beautiful moment. Let's put that in the movie." Mm-hmm. But my favorite thing is the most real, raw, of the earth thing in the movie is the English playwright who plays Quint.
Yes!
Just the irony that like this English stage actor plays, who feels like the
Robert
most
Shaw's
has
amazing.
Has lived on the island for 7 centuries or something.
Right. He's like undead.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, there was a local fisherman that was there. And of course, they were out at Martha's Vineyard the entire summer, basically shooting this movie. Mm-hmm. And so there was a local fisherman that was there that was so Quint in just everything about him that some of the stuff he said off camera, Robert Shaw just like picked it up and was like, "I'll be saying that."
Right.
Nice. This guy basically is Quint, and like that kind of stuff, unless you're really immersed in that, you can't fake it or write it. It just has to spring out of the like culture of the place.
Hello, listener. If you've heard us talk about Mubi before, the curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe, then you've probably heard us talk about various films we've discovered through Mubi. And maybe you wanted to check it out, but missed the window when that film was featured on Mubi's Now Playing section. Well, I have good news. Mubi recently launched the Mubi Library, a new section allowing members to revisit and discover hundreds of films that have been previously handpicked by their curators. If you're already a member, this is available to you at no additional cost. If you're not a member, there's no better time to join, as there are hundreds of films now available. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. Once again, that's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Something that's interesting about this idea of overlapping dialogue, how technology has
I know what
helped
you're going to say, Michael, and I think it's interesting. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was waiting for somebody to do something.
I know. Someone's going to get smart about this.
Yeah.
Cute, Brian, great. Cute.
It's been 15 minutes. Brian hasn't been and asked anyone yet.
So watching Jaws and liking that and the naturalism and the fluidity that it added to the experience. Something I do a lot when watching a movie is think about what was happening on set in that moment.
Of course.
And I'm just thinking about the poor sound recordist who's like, "You're doing a one-er on a ferry, uh-huh. and you want me to record everything?" Or like, this idea of overlapping dialogue also was clearly not intended for use in video essays, because it makes it very hard to use certain lines when right. other people are shouting over them.
Yeah, that was tough.
But I think as technology developed, you know, at the time, you would have one track of dialogue recording, like maybe two if there are like multiple different places and stuff. And now on films, you know, there's the boom mic, but also every single individual actor has a lavalier mic. So they have the audio tracks from everybody in the scene at all times. And I think that allows for a level of control that I think is interesting. And it's interesting that there isn't more of that done because of that.
Right.
Because I think there are moments in Jaws, and probably what was able to happen more in Jurassic Park for this reason, is when you want the audience to be paying a little bit more attention to this line, you could literally just bring up the volume on that and mix the tracks in that way. And so that was just a thought I was having. It's like, oh, this, I want them to have had all these tracks separately so they can mix it just perfectly. It's still great.
I love the story about, of course, the most famous line in this, which was famously ad-libbed, "You're going to need a bigger boat,"
mm-hmm.
where Roy Scheider said it, and they originally had it, like, he basically said it very quickly after the shark came out of the water, you know, and then people screamed in the movie theater, and so no one could hear that line in the movie theater. And so then they like famously spaced it out and was like, okay, let's draw this moment out where he like walks back, give them some time to recover from the shock of the shark, and boost that line in the mix. Like they really just turned the volume up on it because they knew it was such a great line that people need to hear it. So there is some consciousness there where obviously Spielberg is controlling the sound, and to the extent that he was able to do that on set, probably very little, but, you know, at least in the edit and how the movie ended, you know, they were very conscious of what is being heard and what isn't.
That's such an interesting idea also, that is kind of only a theater experience thing, or happens most commonly there anyways. When something happens and the audience reacts, there is often a brief period where they are not taking in new information. And so how and when you play with that, an example that I always think of that isn't a good example, but I think it's it's the clearest example of, oh, they knew exactly what they were doing, is in Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Trek 2, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, where Benedict Cumberbatch reveals finally at the midpoint, he turns and he's like, he's Khan. My name is Khan. Pause. And now we can continue with the scene. And it worked completely in the theater that I was in, where everyone was like, "Whoa, oh my God, yeah.
Were they?
Opening night IMAX, yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't going, we figured that out 6 months ago when he was playing a character named John Harrison.
Like, seriously.
Nah, he's gone.
Right. Anyway, but it's an example of, like, you can lean too far in that direction too.
Right.
Like, when you watch it not in a theater, it's just like, why did the movie stop for 5 seconds?
Right.
Or it's like watching Jaws 3D in 2D, where suddenly it's like someone gets their hand bitten off and you just see a hand floating in the water for the next 15 seconds and it makes no sense when you're not watching it in 3D.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. And Into Darkness wasn't that long ago. I would be interested to know, because test screenings are a thing. We do them, and movies get changed based on test screenings. But I'll be interested to see if that changes at all when movies are no longer getting wide theatrical releases or no theatrical releases. Are we going to change the rhythm of the editing? Are we going to change what test screenings are? Like, maybe there's just a much smaller groups of people watching, or maybe just watching in their homes. I don't know. I would be curious. You know, this movie is heralded as being the first big blockbuster, and it opened on an insane number of screens for the time period. And so the test screenings were really influential on, like, how the finished film ended up being. And that model has dominated from 1975 until right now. And I just wonder if that's going to change at all. And, you know, what Jaws, whatever the next Jaws is going to be, which is probably going to be in, you know, 5 years from now, whatever that's going to look like in terms of, are we scaring the audience? Are we making them laugh? If so, does it change how we cut our movie?
When you say the next Jaws 5 years from now, do you mean the next, like, era defining?
Yeah.
Like, movie that kicks off whatever, like, this thing is,
whatever the new blockbuster quote unquote is,
right?
Not Jaws 5 this time. It's even personaler.
Well, speaking of the movie theater experience, I was so delighted watching it just alone at home, and but thinking about how it must have been in the theater to watch that first beach scene where,
oh my God,
they've kept the beach open. It's not the 4th of July scene, it's the Alex Kittner scene, but the way the sound is mixed in that scene, where all the kids are playing in the ocean, they're just screaming at the top of their lungs.
Yeah.
So there's these random sudden screams, but it's like playful screams, and there's like a dog paddling in the water, and the way the sound mix happens in that scene and the way it's cut is such masterful suspense. And I was just so impressed with the construction of that sequence and thinking about how much fun and how tense it would be in a theater for the first time watching that sequence. Yeah, I it made me realize why this was such a popcorn movie, you know, way before they get to the big shark attack stuff at the end.
Yeah.
It's a horror scene, but it's not a normal horror setting, which is something I was also really impressed with. It's like, it's a wide open beach. There's tons of people around, but because of what the killer is in this situation, there's still room. Like, all those things actually add to the tension. And so it was cool. I was thinking about Alien a lot, actually, while watching it, too.
Right.
Sure.
Where it's like, you know, they're very different, but, like, similar also in a lot of ways. But, you know, take place in completely different environments. And Alien, you know, you're trapped alone on a big thing and there's no safety in numbers. There's, you know, and Jaws, it's interesting also that kind of, as you pointed out earlier, Trisha, at the midpoint, a new movie begins.
Yes, it does.
And right. it's like, it's one of the clearest shifts where the first half is more horror tense. The monster's going to come kill us. And then the second half is more adventure. We're going out and we're going to tackle this, and it's the team and all that stuff. There's such different halves, mm-hmm. but it works, and like the handoff is earned such that you're on board, so to speak, with them and their journey.
There's even like jaunty sea music to send them off, you know, from right. John Williams, yeah, signaling that change in genre.
Yeah, I think that one thing this movie does really well, going back to the beach scene you're talking about, Alex, is capture the horror of responsibility.
Yes.
Right?
Like, because you're in Chief Brody's head
exactly.
in that moment. Yeah,
right.
Where that, like, the very fact of the beach being crowded is the horror, right? He did everything that he could to keep people away from the danger. He was not able to keep the beaches closed. And so the actual, like, crazy amount of activity that is happening on that beach is horrifying, because you know that you can't watch it all at the same time. I mean, I'm not a parent, but I would imagine that's the horror of parenting, right? What it's
right.
And of course, Brody is a parent, and that's, he's worried most about his own children and his own family. And so the just complete chaos of that beach scene that he has no control over, it taps into that psychological, like, I'm supposed to keep this under control. There is no way that I can keep it under control. And so, I don't know, it's a really clever, like, psychological idea to tap into when you're putting us in this scene. Why is it scary? It's scary because we are Brody, and we know that we can't keep everything contained and keep everyone safe.
Right. And you have two sides of that that really make it effective. One of which is a protagonist who's completely unequipped to deal with the situation. Like, he can't stop
Absolutely.
A shark by himself. And that's what we get into in the video. But on the other side of it, you know, if it's Alien, which was pitched as Jaws in Space, which we
of
talked
course.
About in our Aliens
right,
podcast,
right.
It's, well, they're on a spaceship together. They can't go anywhere. But when it's Jaws, it's all anyone has to do is not go in the water, but, and so that's the only thing he has to keep them from doing. And guess what? He can't.
Yep.
And partially because the mayor doesn't let him, and partially because he just can't run around convincing everyone not to go in the water because maybe there's a shark. And that's how you get a horror scene that happens in broad daylight, is because it's not Jason running through the crowd and then having to run away and hope no one catches up to him. It's, you know, it's the shark gets someone and nobody else can do anything. They can't go attack them. They just swim away and hope to survive. So it just makes for a really interesting and unique take on horror that doesn't require containment. It just requires people to not stay inside.
crowded beaches. Hashtag 2020.
To touch on it without touching on it, I think it's, I appreciate that the movie goes far enough in making me understand where the antagonist is coming from. Like, that's always, you know.
Are you talking about Vaughn or the shark?
Mayor Vaughn.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Oh,
not,
yeah.
Not the shark.
He was going to say the antagonist being the shark.
I thought you were just going to talk for 5 minutes about how you understand what it's like to be hungry.
The shark. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what it's
sharks
like to
be hungry.
Shark. Yeah. I mean, I could. The water, we are not supposed to be in the water. Humans should be on the land. The water is where the aliens live.
I mean, they really do.
The ocean, I forget some comedian was like, the ocean is just constantly throwing people out of it. And we're just constantly trying to get back into it. But Mayor Vaughn, you know, as frustrating as he is, you understand where he's coming from and the decisions that he's making. So it doesn't make it okay. You're not on his side. It actually just makes it that much more frustrating, where it's like he has his responsibility and his goals, and this is a risk that, you know, one could understand why someone might, you know, lean one way or another. And I think that I appreciated that it's not just an evil, you know, mustache twirling
right.
like bad guy. And I think that adds almost to the psychological dread of it, because Definitely. It's like, oh, this could happen. This could be what humans do, and this
right.
there could be consequences to those things.
Economic considerations yeah. versus health.
Like, bad guys don't wear pink leisure suits. It must be okay. They got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
What, you know, what's so interesting is, so this movie came out in 1975, and then I happened to write, when we were starting to talk about this film, I also watched Taxi Driver for the first time, which came out in 1976. And I was thinking about it, it's like, so this is like the same time period. And so I saw in like two movies back to back, like where Brody came from, which was like the grungy mid-1970s New York. Yep. And then this other world that existed at the exact same time, which was this kind of New England idyllic, you know, resort town. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was really fascinating too, just to think about. I like Taxi Driver gave me this weird context for like the city where people are coming from and where what Brody's past was and how this is so radically different from his, you know, New York City upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it creates a lot of, I mean, we don't need more sympathy for Brody because, like I said, the film so firmly plants us in like why he's there, what his responsibility is, and we are just with him from the start. But his background, this goes back to the character design piece, is really important. So like when you see him on the boat and his response is to strap on his revolver, right, where he's just like, I'm gonna get my police gun and like shoot the shark with this like handgun essentially over the side of the boat, that's what he knows how to do. And even the politics of navigating this like small town, of course, why would he be able to have, he has no notion of what it is to be in a small town, to have to deal with your neighbors, to have to deal with like the Boy Scouts that are doing their mile swim for the thing over there, right? It's just so far beyond the bounds of his experience. And it reminded me a little bit of what we were talking about with A Quiet Place, which is like the design of the character, especially the protagonist, is uniquely disadvantaged, but in some ways perfectly suited to mm-hmm. handle this situation. So, you know, it was interesting. I don't think I wrote the line in the video that we did about this, but it's like, he's the perfect guy. He has none of the skills, but all of the motivation. And so that's a really smart design principle for a protagonist here, especially one that is, you know, the situation gets increasingly and increasingly worse, as is very, very cleverly done in this.
I always think about Frodo as the ultimate example, of course, Lord of the Rings, yeah. You know? None of the skills, none of the prerequisites, but all the, you know, heart and determination to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's also a good example of setting. And this is, again, kind of just an obvious thing, but I think that's maybe even why it works. But in some ways, of course, a shark attack is only going to happen at a place where there's water, right? Like, sure. And then, but because it's a resort town that like requires the water mm-hmm. to be open.
It's the
like
reason to go there.
Yeah. Right. And I think I see things like that, and I think the first thought can be like, isn't that kind of dumb or like kind of obvious? But the way it's, you know, put in the story, it's like, no, it's not dumb. It's the only way it could possibly work. And that's why it works so well and just feels so effortless.
Well, it's the worst place that a giant great white shark could decide to like camp out for the summer.
Right.
it's which is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, too, I like the, it's not a major theme in the movie, but it's really wisely observed in terms of like class, if I can put it that way.
Mm.
You have to get this sense of like financial precariousness of the town where like one bad summer could ruin everything.
Right.
Like
stakes.
Pitching this as this like lower middle class most of the year. This lower middle class town that's like they're fishing, they're blue collar people, they're quint, right? So they have to be able to have this big summer like thing, this seasonal thing. It's just really smartly observed and really well drawn where the stakes feel real, like you were saying, Michael, for the mayor, because they have to. If the mayor's stakes aren't real, then he's not a formidable antagonist for Brody. And so you have to get the sense, you know, just as Brody is dealing with that horror of his responsibility, Mayor Vaughn is dealing with the horror of his responsibility. And so, it just is the perfect like the puzzle pieces fit together perfectly, interlocking in exactly the way that they need to create the difficult dilemma. Because that's really what most screenwriting is. If you're writing conflict, the conflict has to be as difficult as possible. So the pieces have to fit together to make it the worst that it can be.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of the worst it could be, should we talk about the making of this movie a little bit?
Oh my God. 100 days over schedule.
Oh my God. That's stressful. It's like Apocalypse Now.
100 days over schedule. It's so long. And it's so much. It's like $5 million. Like it's double the budget. It's more than double the budget. It's more than like double the production. It's triple the production schedule. What a nightmare.
And you're 26 and you're the
and
director
you're 26
of this movie.
Years old. I like how Spielberg has been honest since then. And of course, by the way, there's lots of information about the production of Jaws. There's a making of documentary. There's an amazing podcast about it. People have spoken about it at length, so you can check out all of that stuff. But I love how honest Spielberg has been about his own inexperience. And he was like, listen, I insisted that we all go out to Martha's Vineyard and do this whole thing and wrestle with wind and water and sun, crew members getting sunburned and heat stroke and windswept. And I could have just shot it in a tank in North Hollywood, but I was 26 and I didn't know, like, I didn't realize that and know that. And so he learned a lot. And it's what you're saying, Michael. We see the roots of how much he matured during the production of this movie in his other films. And the fact that this movie came together as with Apocalypse Now, just because it turned out great doesn't mean you should make a movie like this.
Right. Right.
For the record.
I saw a great quote by him in some interview for a making of documentary. And he was saying that at that point in my life, when I was younger, I was more courageous, or maybe I was just more stupid. And so when I think of Jaws, I think of courage and stupidity and both of those things underwater. the way he summed up his Jaws experience.
And both of those things underwater.
Yeah.
One thing I like about the trials of the movie is obviously the main one is that the shark didn't work. And the
Thank
documentary
God it didn't work.
Right, of course. The documentary that came out in 2005 is called The Shark Is Still Working, which is about Jaws itself, but also covers the actual literal shark, too. I think there's two lessons in that, one of which is the one everyone says, which is that things are scarier when you don't see them. And we see that a lot. I've mentioned Silence of the Lambs versus Hannibal, the movie, where it's talking about these things versus we're just going to show you a guy with his head off. And it's like, well, that's not scary anymore. And that's sort of the obvious one that always gets mentioned when it comes to what came out of the shark not working. But I think that the other one is that restraints are often what make art great. Is once you, especially now,
hard agree,
when you can do anything,
yeah,
it's the things that you can't do that sometimes cause the best ideas to come, you know? And you get that from the restraints of movie structure of, okay, it should be around this length. It should have roughly this kind of structure to it. And people say, oh man, movie structure doesn't work. Da da da. Like everything is formulaic. And I've never heard those people get angry that paintings are in a frame,
right?
You know, or that sonnets rhyme. Like it's just that is the thing. That is your framework. Now it's so much more challenging to see what you can do within that framework than it is to just do anything. And yeah.
And the most famous example of this, of course, from Jaws is the barrels. Like Spielberg didn't have a shark to shoot, so he was like, "Give me those barrels. We'll shoot these barrels." The barrels are so upsetting when they come up to the surface, of course. But there's a lot else that came out of, like we said, all of the problems in the production ended up yielding something that was ultimately better because they ended up having a lot more time to refine the script, which they wouldn't have had before. They ended up having to get super creative when they were figuring out ways to shoot the shark because they didn't have a shark to shoot. And all kinds of manifestations, especially in the first half of this, but also in the second half of this, of like, I think about the dock, right? Where when the shark pulls, those two idiots are out on the dock.
Right.
And the shark pulls the dock out. And then why would it work this way? It definitely shouldn't. But the two posts at the end of the dock are going out to sea, and then they turn around and they start they start getting dragged back in. It's one of the scariest things where, and then you have that the guy, he's on the sloping edge of the dock that's down right. in the water, and his feet, he's trying to claw his way back up. All that comes out of the constraint of the issue with the shark. So much of the genius of Spielberg was born out of the difficulties of this production.
Well, I think what works about the movie ultimately is that there's still a great payoff at the end. It's not like we never see the shark.
Oh,
like
hell
we get,
yeah,
we get
is.
Plenty of shark at the end. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, I don't think the finale would feel as fun and crazy if we had seen shark the whole time. And there's some shots of a real great white in that finale. There's that part where it's kind of thrashing on top of the cage was actually yeah. filmed in Australia with like a mm-hmm. half-size cage to make a normal great white look like a giant great white. And I remember watching the movie and I saw that shot. I'm like, wait a minute, that's a real shark. What the hell? I thought this was all animatronics. So they managed to pull off something special in that finale. And yeah, there are like the extra cheesy shots, but when he's in the shark cage, that sequence I think is pretty fantastic and holds up because sharks do look weird and sharks, fish and sea animals like don't move in normal ways and like have don't have like expressive like face. They don't have faces really, you know. So I do think that the animatronic shark works pretty darn well, you know. Michael's shaking his head about the fish and
a fish water. Yeah, there we should not be there. Clearly, there are things I want
to
eat. Us.
I remember talking to Michael about scuba diving because I love scuba diving. I love the ocean, and him just like
too.
Being like that's the opposite of anything I would ever want to do ever.
Well, yes. That reminds me, Alex, because we should talk about Cooper for a few minutes and about Quint. Mm. So Cooper dies in the book, and he dies in the original draft of the script, like. He goes, so after Quint, no, before Quint gets chomped, Cooper goes into the water and he's supposed to die and get killed by the shark. They had that amazing footage from Australia where the shark attacked the cage, but nobody was in the cage. And so Spielberg was like, we got to use this. Let's just say Hooper like escaped and he like swam away. Right. And so then we can use this amazing footage of this great white attacking this empty cage. But I think it's the right call.
Yeah, I don't want to see Richard Dreyfuss die. It's Richard Dreyfuss.
Well, not that version of him.
What version of Richard Dreyfuss do you want?
There's like, what about Bob Richard Dreyfuss? He's played.
Oh, but he's just like great.
He's
that
played.
Too,
he's
though.
Played like crappy people before. Like he's not always the likable hipster.
Yeah, his name is Richard Dreyfuss. I don't know. I just like him. I miss him. I wish he was in more things.
I mean, it is a little convenient that after everyone's gone and Brody has to take care of the shark by himself, suddenly Hooper shows up and hey, I'm still here.
I mean, he had his scuba tank on. If I were him, I would have just hid down in the kelp as well. I would I would stay out of the way.
And it's a good thing the shark really wanted to keep attacking the person up on the boat and
right.
not the person in the
right.
water.
All right.
he camouflaged with like the seabed.
Well, but I think Hooper's survival does a lot to create that rich thematic argument, I guess, that we could. I mean, this is not in anywhere close to the Jurassic Park level of rich thematic argument, because this is very much like a man versus nature kind of thing, like I said. But when you have Hooper and Quint, who are on these really opposite sides in terms of their respect for nature and how they relate to it, I think if you have them both get equally chomped, it says something totally different than if Cooper, who loves sharks and really respects them and is trying to kill the shark in a more humane way, potentially, if he also gets chomped, it really changes kind of like where we land with this movie.
Sure.
And so I think that character development or that character design would almost feel not paid off, or it would be more of an example of like bathos that we've talked about, where you build something up and then steal it away. If Hooper were to die at the end of this, his companionship with Brody, where we like them together, we think they make good friends, they have great enough conflict, but they still like are helping each other and are willing to work together. If all of that buildup of Hooper being the first ally that's introduced and Hooper, you know, relating to Brody's family a little bit more, there's an embracing technology, embracing the future. It sort of contributes all of this stuff to like where now the thematic reading of it means something totally different than it did, than it would if it went the other way.
I feel like it would like solidify that sharks are evil.
Right.
And
right.
I feel like it's not right. quite at that level.
Like the shark also ruined a friendship.
It could have been a beautiful friendship, like the end of Casablanca. And Mads. Right.
It's kind of Casablanca.
It's very Casablanca.
I love the very ending there.
Yeah.
Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The final exchange between the two.
Yeah. Just going off into the sunset.
Yeah.
I really like all three of these characters are three-dimensional. They feel lived in. The performances are amazing. Again, there's many, many reasons why, as a trio, we remember them all almost equally. They're large enough personalities, and the way that they work together is very compelling.
What Spielberg says is his favorite scene in the movie, which is Quint's speech about the sharks in World War II when his boat sank. I remember my dad always referencing that scene. Like, even when I hadn't seen the movie yet, when I was a kid, and maybe even after I'd seen it just once, but I forgot it, like, he would bring that scene up a lot of just the doll's eyes, talking about the shark's eyes.
You know, the thing about a shark is he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes.
Exactly.
I knew you had a Quint. I knew you had a Quint impression in there.
He's got an everybody impression in there.
You get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
So one thing I heard on this making of was that Robert Shaw was a big drinker and often drinking like between takes on set, like constantly.
Yep.
So like they did that scene twice. And like for one of the like times they shot it, he was actually super drunk.
Uh-huh.
And part of his performance in that scene, he's like almost blackout drunk. And then other shots, he's not quite. And apparently you can like see his eyes are more glassy in some shots than others. But some of that delivery was like he like didn't even remember doing the performance because he was so drunk.
Well, the thing about a drunk is he's got glassy eyes.
It's like a doll's eyes.
Yeah, I mean, he's a kind of a tragic character in this movie. Like,
definitely.
Robert Shaw, not Quint, but Robert Shaw is kind of a tragic character in this movie where he died a year later. He didn't make any money in this movie. He didn't really have much money. He basically said he hadn't enjoyed making a movie and 15 years or 20 years or something
from Russia with Love.
Yeah, it was. So it's just unfortunate that this was sort of, I mean, what a way to go out, to leave behind this character, obviously, but it's just unfortunate to know that someone was that unhappy during film. Not that he was unhappy necessarily every day on filming, but just in life, you know.
If you're drinking constantly, there's probably something. Not
I mean,
sure.
Everybody was unhappy every day of filming, I'm pretty sure.
Right,
sure.
Right.
So, and like these guys were seasick for so much of this time when they were out on the Orca. So like the amazing scene, and to me, it's one of Roy Scheider's best moments in it, but after Quint smashes the radio, and Roy Scheider just and Brody just comes back at him and is like, that's great. That's just great. And completely loses his cool. Like 2 seconds after Spielberg said cut, like Roy Scheider just leaned over and vomited, like because he was so ill. It's just very hellish. Again, going back to Apocalypse Now, there's a reason we don't make movies like this anymore.
Why are all these people making movies in the hardest possible ways?
I mean, it does it looks really amazing though, because there are some really beautiful shots of the ship at sea during sunset and these wide vistas, and you wouldn't have that in a backlot.
I love how Spielberg was, they had like guys in a motorboat or a speedboat, and they would just like send them to pay off whoever was sailing into their shot. So like a sailboat would like come across the horizon, and he'd be like, go give that guy $100. And they would like send the boat over there and give that guy $100 to move his sailboat, because Spielberg was so obsessed with having those wide open vistas with no other ships anywhere on them.
Well, and he was saying that sometimes it would take like an hour or like hours for the ship to like finish crossing the frame in the back. So like, it just everything. Yeah, shooting at sea sounds so horrible.
Completely terrible. But I mean, again, we have the movie that we have today. Thank God. I don't recommend.
We weren't part of the production, so we can be happy about it.
Yeah, exactly. And Verna Fields, I want to talk about Verna Fields for a few minutes, who put this movie together in the edit. Like, God bless, because if you read the script, it's a mess. Like, even though they did refine it, the script is nowhere close to the movie that we have. And like, they would shoot and shoot, and she was working just with the footage that they were able to get, and so was Spielberg, and they were just kind of, as you were saying, Brian, let's plow ahead and put together a movie in whatever way we can and shoot whatever it is that we can in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. I found out her house was where they shot the head coming out of the boat.
Uh-huh.
That shot, they actually shot it
in her pool.
In her pool in Van Nuys. And I used to live in Van Nuys, and I looked up her house, and it's like a mile from where I used to live.
Shooting at sea, all that sounds exhausting. Because again, I think someone had to be like, okay, everyone's ready to throw up, but the camera's on the... So roll camera, and then for like, you know, 30 seconds, everyone has to be like on top of their game, and then cut, and then go back to the horribleness. Or even in the edit, we're like, how do you edit this movie when you're literally cutting and pasting? Like, that still blows my mind that editing that manual.
Right.
So yeah, it is extremely impressive that we have these films. Mm-hmm. And people went through the things that they went through. And, you know, I'm sure people did that on movies that aren't great and that we don't still remember.
Right.
But it also delivered some of the greatest films, which I can now acknowledge Jaws is.
Thank you so much.
Nice.
We did it.
They delivered the bum. The Hiroshima bum.
And we absolutely would not have the movie that we have without John Williams. That also has to be named here.
Can we just press once again the John Williams is cheat code button?
Yeah.
Right.
This was the original John Williams cheat code. Like, he had done a couple movies before this, but this was the one that really kickstarted his career. And of course, Spielberg's career. It's one of the most iconic scores of all time. I was thinking back about that to that scene on the beach where the camera's underwater. Everyone is screaming. The children are screaming. Everyone's kicking and splashing. And what we hear are those two notes and nothing else played on a tuba. Why would they be played on a tuba? Like, it's...
Sharks are really into tubas.
It's that minimalist approach that creates that sense of dread. And when so much other, like, sound and Spielberg is very consciously trying to overwhelm us with all of the chaos, to go super minimalist and quiet on the score and have it creeping under and creeping under. It's such a genius move. And I love that. And then I also love the adventure, as you were saying, Alex, the Adventure Time, like, pirate score that's in the second half of this, where they're just like, we're hunting a shark now.
Mm-hmm.
The barrel scene, it's like, it's almost like from a different movie, it feels
ba-da-dum,
like.
Ba-da-da.
Yeah.
I saw this at the Hollywood Bowl with the LA Phil, which I've mentioned three times on the podcast. Literally, the only three movies I've seen were Empire Strikes Back, Jurassic Park, and Jaws in that context. And Jaws is a weird one because you have those moments of music that you remember so well. And then you have lots of moments where there's no music, and then the music comes in slowly, and you're just engrossed in the film, and you forget there's a symphony playing it. And suddenly mm-hmm. you look down and you're going, oh, wow, this music is live. But the music sometimes is so subtle for a movie where the music is thought of to be so bombastic and in your face. It's really not for most of the movie in a very effective way.
And I think that simplicity allows you to just quickly associate it with the meaning that it needs to have. Where exactly. When you hear these two notes, it means shark coming. And like, once that has been established, you can then use it over and over again to create that amazing effect.
And you can use it to mess with your audience. So now we're expecting to hear it. And then in the most terrifying moments when the shark appears, there's no music and it just comes out of the depths of the water, which it's that primal horror of something attacking you from a place where you can't see it until it's basically on top of you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ugh!
It's such a fascinating jump scare because it doesn't do any of the jump scare things.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't bring down the sound with then a like crazy punctuation, like when Richard Dreyfuss sees the bloated head in the boat and there's like a Halloween film.
Scream.
And scream.
It sounds like when you like step on one of those cheap like Halloween doormats that like lets off a scream. It sounds like that sound effect. Like,
right.
Where it's just clearly this is here to scare you. But no, like the shark just like comes out. And then, like, the soundtrack doesn't
do anything, doesn't react.
Mess with the, yeah, but it's still, it's still really, really scary.
Yeah. I love this movie. Well, I remember where I was. I mean, I was 8 years old when I saw it, and, which is maybe too young.
That's pretty young.
For Jaws. But there's something so perfect about the structure of it. Two, which we don't have to spend a ton of time talking about, but just like you were pointing out, it's a very clear shift at a midpoint. It's this nice build of exposition and into the beginning of the second act. It has that like hero's journey, like perfect structure kind of thing. And then it builds to the most satisfying climax imaginable, which was also really, it's different than the book, of course, and it's different than the original script. Spielberg was like, well, what if this shark exploded?
Because it's such a ridiculous thing, too. Like, that's what makes it so impressive that it works so well, is that right. It actually earns the satisfaction of, I don't want to see them just kill the shark. I want to see them make the shark explode.
It feels like, yeah, obviously you have to. You know, it's like the shark is so unkillable in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Like, it does earn it. They struggle so much that it does feel like the only way to really stop this thing is to actually explode it from the inside. That's the only way.
I remember where I was when I saw the shark explode and where I was when I saw the Death Star explode for the first time. I would say those are on par, like, satisfying explosions.
Interesting.
Very similar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was in my living room.
In the special edition, they should make sure they add rings coming out of the shark when he explodes. Yes, yes. So
it's shockwave rings. Yeah, right. Better.
So it's more realistic.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a perfect structure. And so there's a reason why this has become so prototypical, right? It was a high concept movie. It was the first blockbuster, and it was perfectly structured. And the script turned out to be, I don't know, do I want to call it a perfect script? I'm not sure about that, but it turned out to be the story that needed telling and, you know, well put together. So they tried for years to make this movie over and over again.
Right. I do feel like my only complain about it structurally is I do think it drags a bit in the second half, you know, in a way. You know, I think it could have been trimmed down a little bit and been a tighter, like, it wouldn't have been as like equal as far as like where the midpoint lands, but I think their adventure at sea could have been tightened, because I feel like everything in the first half I wouldn't cut a thing out. And maybe it's just part of the difficulty of filming at sea. It just feels different because this is what they got, you know. But that's my one. It's why it doesn't have the same place in my heart as like a Jurassic Park. There's something about that second half where I do zone out a little bit for some periods.
As of this recording, there are currently 344 patrons for Beyond the Screenplay, and we want to thank each and every one of you for making this podcast possible. We've recently added some new perks to our Patreon that give us new opportunities to connect with you guys. Our $2 tier gives you access to a monthly patron exclusive bonus episode. This is where you can find our episodes on Pirates of the Caribbean, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and Scott Pilgrim. Our new $5 tier gives you access to a monthly live Q&A, where we answer questions and share our thoughts on topics submitted by our patrons. Finally, our $10 tier gives you access to our monthly Film Club video chat. This is where we all get on a video chat with you and other patrons around the world. Everyone gets to share their thoughts on the film of the month, and we all get to hang out and talk about movies. So if you were considering becoming a patron, now is a great time. There are these fun new perks, and you'll also be helping us get closer to our goal of 500 patrons, at which point we'll do a three-part series on The Lord of the Rings. The link to our Patreon is in the show notes, or you can simply go to patreon.com/beyondthescreenplay. And now, back to the episode.
The funny thing is, both Jurassic Park and Jaws are within 2 minutes of each other lengthwise.
Interesting.
But I noticed it when I put on Jurassic Park when we were watching it for our podcast, was that they're both 2 hours and 4 or 6 minutes. Which is just a length no movie is, weirdly. Like, every movie is just under 2 hours, like 145 to 155, somewhere in there. Or it's 2 hours, 20 minutes, 2.5 hours, something like that.
Right.
And for some reason, it just struck me when I put it on. I just thought, I'm not used to seeing that timestamp come up when I start a movie, that it's like just over 2 hours. So they're actually very close to time-wise. But obviously, Jurassic Park, you have so much going on in the second two acts of the movie, in a way that Jaws is, you can only have so much going on with three characters and a shark.
And barrels.
Yeah.
Part of me, because I felt that too, but part of me wonders also, if I was sitting in a theater in 1975, would I feel that? Or would this feel like an epic where, you know, it's the fourth act of The Dark Knight, where there's this movie now also, like, it's not just a horror movie. Now we're on a sea adventure. Like, maybe, you know, that had some kind of novelty or created a sense of unexpected storytelling that maybe propelled an audience back then further than it might today.
Yeah, maybe.
Conjecture. But
I don't know. This actually has something to do with my lesson. So are we almost at lesson part?
We are exactly at lesson part.
Okay.
Tricia, why don't you tell us what lesson you're taking away from Jaws?
So my lesson about this is obviously related to what we talked about in the video, but one thing I think this movie is a great example of is having enough twists and turns. Because I've been reading a lot of screenplays lately, and one of the things I've been noticing is there's not enough plot. Like, I think that we have, perhaps, there's been a trend in slowing down or letting characters talk or sort of just like letting, and maybe that's not even a trend, but some of the scripts that I've been reading just don't have enough plot in them. There's not enough twists and turns. And I think the thing about Jaws and some of these older model of films, something like Star Wars, say, or some of these other big archetypal films, not something like Apocalypse Now, but
one but of a kind.
You just have to have enough reversals where you're moving in a direction and then you get blocked, and you're moving in a direction and then you get blocked. And so we were talking about, as we were working on the video for this, this model of like two steps forward and one step back. Every scene basically has to be one of those two things. It either has to be a step forward or it has to be a step back, but that in itself is plot. And so even if you have cleverly designed characters that are introducing conflict, the conflict has to be big enough to be considered plot. And so and that was the thing that originally drew me to Jaws, when Brody and Hooper and Quint are working together, the plot is moving. They are moving toward their goal in concrete, noticeable, measurable steps. They get another barrel into him, right? They are getting closer and closer to catching him. When they are not working together, they are getting further away from catching him, where the ship starts sinking. They burn the engine out, whatever it is. There has to be noticeable, measurable plot, even if it's just three characters on a boat. And so there's enough plot in this movie. And there's not more than you need. I don't know. It's just a really, really smartly designed. No scene is wasted. Every scene is plot. This thing happens. They are going to catch the shark, or it seems like they're going to catch the shark. Then something blocks them. They have to make a different plan. Every scene is plot, basically.
Yeah. And I think there's like an efficiency to that, obviously. It's kind of what you're saying. But I think what I'm thinking about as I'm listening to that is that I think there can be a tendency to want to have like character scenes and character development and like a conversation where they're talking about things that'll then set up the next thing that's going to happen. And I think those need to be happening at the same time. Like the plot needs to be character, the character needs to be plot. And so that's hard, but I feel like that's maybe a trend I've noticed, is that leaning too much toward the like, well, plot is bad. I don't want, you know, that. I want,
yeah,
like,
I just want characters.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But the Indianapolis scene is the example of that, where it's a critical character reveal. We absolutely need it. And it reveals so much about everybody that's in it, where Hooper is sitting there and he's talking about his own life experiences, which are dramatically different than Quint's, of course. And he and Quint are swapping scar stories. Brody's just kind of off in the corner where he feels like he's not really a part of this thing. Then we get this incredible backstory character reveal from Quint. And 2 seconds later, the shark rams the boat. Like,
it's
that level of efficiency where you're not having a scene that's only doing character work or only doing plot. All the plot is also doing character work, and all the character work scenes are driving forward the plot.
And that's an exceptional scene, right? Like, not every scene is someone monologuing for 2 minutes about a thing and then something else happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's very instructive.
Word. Awesome. Alex?
I think I say this often, but I just really appreciate Spielberg's commitment to the horror of this movie, you know, because it has the John Williams score. It has the jaunty fun elements as well. So there could be a more sanitized version of Jaws that's a little more kid friendly. But it opens with this really grisly scene. You don't see any gore, but the way this woman is screaming in the water and being dragged around for like a long period of time before she finally goes under really sets the tone right up front of just like, no, like it's very painful to die from a shark attack. It might take a long time. And it's just like really, really, really horrible. It's not like
it still upsets me so much when I watch it.
Right.
I've seen it probably 20 times and I'm still horrified by it.
It's not like a quick, clean, just like surprise death. It's like a long, drawn out ordeal, which is probably more accurate to what happens when an animal slowly eats you.
But nature's great and we should go in the water all the time.
Gotta play it safe over there, Michael.
And same with the commitment to the Alex Kittner scene where it's like
literally
a torn up raft with blood on it. And then you see a mother like screaming for her son for a little while. Like it's really it's not sugarcoating it at all. It's really horrific. And I really appreciate that because it makes the enemy that much scarier because you're not in like the safe movie land of like, oh, it's a fun shark movie with like fun deaths and fun adventure. It's like, no, like this is very terrifying actually, and the shark killing anybody else is going to be terrifying, not necessarily even fun. So I respect to Spielberg for going that direction.
And the scene where Mrs. Kittner confronts Brody is one of the most gut-wrenching scenes in movie history, as far as I'm concerned.
I love that casting of that mom. Like,
oh, she's wonderful.
She looks so authentic and just looks just
Lee
like,
Fierro is her name. Yeah.
And the shark is still working. They talk about how she would just get asked to slap people for the rest of her life. So I can't tell you how many people I've slapped because they came up and asked me to. And I just read this story where she went to a restaurant and she was looking at the menu and they had the Alex Kittner sandwich. And she said, yeah. And she was like, this is weird.
What the
hell? She talked to the server and said, hey, I see you have this thing on your menu. I actually played his mom in the movie. And the waiter said, I'll be right back. And the restaurant owner runs out and it's Jeffrey Voorhees, who played Alex, who was the owner of the restaurant. And they hadn't seen each other since the filming.
So it's a happy ending.
Oh my God. Yeah.
He's alive.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Brian, what's your lesson?
Yeah. So on our Jurassic Park podcast, I talked about Jaws and Jurassic Park and Rocky, how with all those movies, the sequels sort of take the high concept thing and just drill down on that. And there's sort of more actiony, gimmicky stuff and less actual story. And watching this documentary, The Shark Is Still Working, there was all this focus on how scary the movie was. The trailer had Percy Rodriguez, who did a lot of trailer voices back then. He said, it's as if God created the devil and gave him Jaws. And I was watching it and people were talking about how scared they were in the theater and how terrified they were to go in the water afterwards. And I thought, I forgot Jaws was a horror movie, like, or that it was even thought of, partially because we've been spending so much time talking about the character interactions and everything. And then I remembered I was scared as a kid. I also saw it when I was pretty young. I think my babysitter had it on in the house and had the entire franchise on. So I saw 4 Jaws movies in one day when I was 8 or 9 or something. And I was literally worried a shark was going to come through the window of my second story bedroom.
Sure.
It was just going to show up.
Right.
And of course, being in a pool whenever you're in the deep end and there's just sort of, there's an expanse that you're not used to having where you just can't quite see in the distance. Even playing Super Mario 64, there's this very cute, Loch Ness Monster type thing. And it's very cute. But I remember being under the water in the game and looking at it and going, oh, it's weird that it's a big thing above me in the water. There's something unsettling about it. But I think the lesson here is that the movie stops being a horror movie because you're not scared by it anymore once you've seen it a trillion times. But when your stories and characters are compelling, they become just as iconic as the genre elements of your story.
And you get
that from the story being interesting. You get that from these three-dimensional characters, as we've been talking about. You know, how easy would it have been for Hooper to be a super nerd constantly pushing up his glasses, and for Quint to be just very negative and joyless all the time, but they're not. All these characters have this fluidity and this dimensionality to them. I think when you think about all three of those movies that I mentioned, half of the most iconic moments come from that gimmicky thing. It's, oh, the shark coming out of the water, or it's the first time you see the T-Rex. But the other half don't. The other half are just these great lines mm-hmm. or character moments or story beats. And some of them may come out of the high concept, the jello shaking or right. or you're going to need a bigger boat. But that's not what makes them interesting. What makes them interesting is how well made the movie is and how well crafted the characters are.
Yeah.
I'll just say, as a child, there was definitely... Like, so we had a pool here at my parents' house in Arizona, and there was definitely like a game that we played with my dad where like he would like surprise go underwater and stick his hand up like a shark.
Yeah,
fin.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. my brother and I, we were little kids, we would just scream and like get out of the pool because it was like the shark is here. Like, it did not take much for the imagination to be like, you have to get out of the pool right now because the shark right. is here. Like, it was so iconic.
And I mean, of course. This movie destroyed beach attendance in 1975. Like, it honestly fell through the floor. And I mean, can you blame anybody? And conservationists, of course, were right. bemoaning this right. movie. Like,
that is a yeah. real negative side effect, is like sharks right. don't actually kill many people ever. And
no, they don't.
It really gave them a bad name, which is
But they are horrifying. I mean, it's what Michael's been trying to convince us of the whole time, that oceans are the home of monsters, which they are.
That's but I cannot have said it better myself. The ocean is the home of monsters.
They don't actively like kill people the way that Jaws makes you think they do.
Right.
Right. Yeah. They don't see people on top of a pier and think, I'm going to wreck this whole pier so that I can knock right. this one human into the water.
Right.
Yeah. Brian, your lesson kind of ties into my lesson, which is about tone. And I think I've, in general, been trying to wrap my head around tone and what are the elements that like directly create it and trying to robot it, basically. Like, what is tone? How do you like pull it apart and see all the pieces of it?
Stay tuned for our video about tone when we figure it out.
Right. Kind of like you were saying, Brian, like I had the opposite thing happen where I forgot that Jaws was a lot of fun to watch. And I think that's another kind of Spielberg hallmark, is that you go and see a Spielberg film and it has this spectrum of tone where it's terrifying and scary and disturbing, but also super fun. And it's a family like evening out and there's goofy things happening, and Minority Report, there's going to be people's eyes rolling on the ground and weird dark places where someone's experimenting and putting sandwiches. I don't know, Minority Report is weird, but there's also Tom Cruise lands from jumping out of a car into a yoga place where he's upside down. So like, not right. That's probably not like the best example, but just Spielberg's
good example,
like that you can have all of that in a movie. And I think that's something that is, I miss, like,
yeah,
it's really special about Spielberg,
Yeah,
there's something really, you feel like you're getting a well-rounded film experience when you go to see one of his big movies.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's like a whole thing that you've been through by the end. And it's, I don't know, it's really great. So like, I feel like
you have to have awesome. Those laugh moments. And we've talked to death about dynamics, but you have to have those laugh moments to disarm the audience. And so, Carl Gottlieb here, they brought him on to rewrite Benchley's script, and Gottlieb is a comedy writer, and like, Spielberg thought maybe he can just like punch it up and add a couple. And then he basically rewrote the whole thing and kind of leaned more into some of those. They're not goofy, but they're the sort of like those moments of levity where I think about like Richard Dreyfuss going like, yelling at the guys on the boat, and he's like, ha ha, they're all gonna die. Like,
right,
that,
right.
That tone.
Playful, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Why don't we go around and say what we've been watching recently? Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Before I get into mine, I just want to echo one that you mentioned, Michael, which I saw in the theater, If Beale Street Could Talk. I just watched it again the other night, and it's just a beautiful movie. I loved it even more the second time, and it can be upsetting to watch right now, but it can also be very beautiful to watch right now. Very different in tone. I watched Eagle versus Shark.
Nice.
Taika Waititi's first film. It stars Jermaine Clement and Lauren Horsley, who co-wrote the story and who is so awesome in the movie, and I can't believe that she is not a megastar. It's basically Taika's version of Napoleon Dynamite. Like, it really feels like he watched that and said, I can do that. Like, especially Jemaine Clement's character and performance. He literally uses nunchucks in the movie. It's just wow. Napoleon Dynamite. It also co-stars Rachel House, who
I was going to ask if it was Rachel House. Yeah. I love her so much.
Topaz in Ragnarok, and she's mm-hmm. in almost all of Taika's movies. But yeah, it feels sort of Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, like early Wes Anderson, but you also get these glimpses of the Taika-ness that would mm-hmm. come out in his later movies, and it's just a weird, enjoyable watch.
Awesome,
nice.
I remember watching that because I knew Jemaine from Flight of the Conchords. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, he's in a movie, and yeah, it's a quirky, weird, fun 2007 indie film. I enjoyed it. Awesome, Trisha, what are you watching?
I have been on a kick of like late 80s, early 90s, bad erotic thrillers.
I feel like you have a new kick every week.
So weird.
And they're so specific.
Right. It's impossible to guess what they're going to be. So, okay, yes, 80s and 90s erotic thrillers.
Okay, so the 80s and the 90s were a time of great erotic thrillers. They were also a time of very bad erotic thrillers. So because everybody was making erotic thrillers during this time, you can find like a bad erotic thriller with basically any actor that you like. So, for example, I've watched DOA with Dennis Quaid from 1988. I watched Sea of Love with Al Pacino and John Goodman from 1989. I watched Consenting Adults, which is, oh God, it's really bad. Kevin Kline and Kevin Spacey from 1992. Body of Evidence with Madonna and Willem Dafoe from 1993. And then the worst of them all, which is the one I'm here to talk about, Color of Night with Bruce Willis from 1994. Bruce Willis, Jane March, Leslie Ann Warren, Brad Dourif, and Lance Henriksen. Oh my God, it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. So Bruce Willis plays a colorblind psychologist. Well, he's a psychologist who loses his ability to see color when one of his patients, sorry, spoilers, jumps out a window and in the middle of a therapy session. And then he like sees her red blood all over the ground and it like messes him up. And then suddenly he can't see red for the rest of the movie.
What?
Yes. But here's the thing about this movie, Color of Night. It's directed by Richard Rush, who's not a bad director, but this movie is so damn all over the place when it comes to tone, where it's incredibly graphic sex scenes. There's like insane car chase sequences in it that are just like straight bad action movie. Bruce Willis comes to LA and he like takes over this therapy group with these weird people with multiple personalities that are like funny, but it's honestly like it should be a cult classic. It's one of the most terrible movies ever. Please go watch Color of Night. Please go. Bruce Willis is 39 in the movie. Like, that's how old he actually was. And his love interest in it, Jane March, was 21 years old in it. And they have no chemistry. And they're just naked for so much of it. It's unbelievably painful to watch. It's wild.
I feel like you're kind of selling me on watching this movie.
Yeah.
Literally, I will watch it with any of you at any point. I'm kind of obsessed with it now.
All right, so let's make this a cult classic.
I mean, you should watch all the bad erotic thrillers that I just mentioned, but Color of Night is sort of the pinnacle of it in my book.
Just did an IMDb search for Jane March, and she was in a movie called Blood of Beasts, which I feel like is the most successful Lord of the Rings poster ripoff I've ever seen.
Oh,
like, for
God.
A moment, I was like, wait, was she in Lord of the Rings? No,
I mean,
she was in
clearly,
Blood of the Beast.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Wow. Okay, cool.
Anyway, if that's your jam, you're welcome.
Excellent. Alex, what have you been watching?
Mine is much more conventional. My husband and I binged the Apple TV Plus limited series Defending Jacob last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is the limited drama series starring Chris Evans with a beard and Michelle Dockery and Jaden Martell playing their son. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's based on a novel. It's a crime thriller. It's about essentially like an assistant DA's son being charged with murder. And it's basically just a really juicy, unsettling, you know, crime drama. You know, it's basically, if you're down for that and just want kind of a nice, dark, juicy ride for 8 episodes, you know, with the nice chapter cliffhangers with each episode, it's a good ride. And bearded Chris Evans being shot very beautifully, dark, you know, dark, beautiful cinematography. Chris Evans. So yeah, you should watch it.
Wait, is Chris Evans in it? Hang on.
And he has a beard.
No. Yeah, bearded Chris Evans is in it. The guy from Endgame, not the guy from...
Yes,
yeah.
Endgame Chris Evans. In our thumbnail Chris Evans.
There you
or
go.
Infinity War. Infinity War Chris Evans, technically. Because there's a whole shaving scene in Endgame. Cause it was like...
Michael, what are you watching?
I've been watching periodically, kind of every weekend during breakfast. My girlfriend and I watch an episode from Explained, which is a Netflix series by Vox. And so it's kind of an extension of, Vox, the YouTube channel. They have a Netflix series where they do like 15 to 20 minute explainers on a topic. And so sometimes it's, you know, the stock market or income inequality or animals. And like, here are all the reasons we've been studying animals the wrong way. And like, are they smart or are they not smart? And like, are we dumb for thinking they're not smart? Like, it goes into kind of like, you know, they set up an argument and they kind of explore both sides of it. Recently, we watched one on music, and it was a very weird experience because, it's an explainer video. It's talking about, you know, what is music? When does a sound become music? But I had this experience where, like, almost as soon as they started talking about it, I became really emotional, and I spent the whole 20 minutes trying not to cry.
Whoa.
And, like, I can't even really articulate why, but the episode goes into what parts of the brain does an animal need to have to understand music. And so it looks at different animals that can maybe keep rhythm or can identify like tones and stuff. And so there's other animals that have pieces of what music is, but music as we know it is a uniquely human thing, or at least seems to be. And it's also so deeply tied to so many parts of the brain. And that's why it's so, you know, every culture has invented music. It's part of our daily lives. It affects our emotions in all these deep ways. And so it was kind of, it's technical, but they also do a good job of tapping into the emotion. And I think it was just nice to see this is what like a good thing about humanity, just like a purely good thing that is unique to humans and makes it feel like we're not just destroying the planet. We're not just causing problems. Like, we can create this thing that is music, that is universal, and that is beautiful. And it gets into like all the like nerdy details of that, which I also love. So, the Vox Explained episode on music was a surprisingly moving little detour out of reality that like helped give me hope again. So
I think it's perfect. Aww. That like Vox Explained is the format with which to like prove to Michael that like humans are like worth, you know, like it helps to have the Vox Explained kind of details there to be like, no, scientifically humans are worth saving, maybe.
It's extremely on brand for you, Michael.
Yeah,
thank you. This has been our conversation on Jaws. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to the patrons for supporting the show and making it possible. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish lady.
Bye.